happy to know that the short series we're going to do for the next 4 or 5 weeks doesn't have a title. I don't know what to call it. It seems like that's the third time, isn't it, that? So what I'll do is I'll try to tell you what we're going to be looking at, and then if you'd like to title it, that's okay. And if you have a good title, I'd appreciate knowing it, so we can put something on the tapes besides, you know, mystery series or something like that. We're going to be looking at 11 out of the 150 Psalms. Not just any 11, but a specific 11 Psalms, a certain group of Psalms. And then we're going to be looking a little bit at Samuel, 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. And a little bit at Chronicles, the historical section of the Old Testament. You say, well, why don't we call it a study of 11 Psalms or of certain Psalms? Well, one reason is we're not going to study the Psalms. We're just going to look at them. In other words, when you study a Psalm, you take it apart, you give an outline, you get the theme, you try to see what the Psalm says in all of its several parts. We're not going to do that. We're just going to take one look at the Psalm. Then we're done. And we're going to take one look at the historical section. We're not going to study that either. We're just going to look at it. And then we're going to take what we looked at in the historical section and what we looked at in the Psalms and try to put it together. So, like I said, I don't know what to call it. As you may or may not know, certain Psalms have headings. Before the Psalm, there's some definite headings, some aren't so definite, some are just obvious, and some are vague. Sometimes the heading just gives the name of the author, a Psalm of Asaph, a Psalm of David, just the name of the author. Sometimes it gives directions to the musicians. Usually it's in Hebrew, so you don't know what he's talking about anyway. But it gives some kind of direction to the director of music, to the musician. Sometime at the heading of a psalm, you have the liturgical use. Like it says, this psalm is to be chanted. Or this psalm is to be done in parts. You'll do one part, you know, like the antiphonal war chant or something like that. Sometime it gives the style of the poem. For example, 4 psalms are alphabetical. They're acrostics. They take the first letter of the alphabet. The first verse has the first letter. Second verse has the second letter. Third verse has the third letter. Psalm 25 is like that. Psalm 119 is like that. And we'll be looking at some others like that. Sometime it names the type of instrument that was used in the psalm. And some of those instruments are pretty weird. We don't have them around today. And most scholars don't really know what they are. They can approximate. They can say, you know, it was a stringed instrument. But that's as far as they can go. That could be anything. Sometime it tells the meter of the psalm and the rhyme. But we're not concerned with that. We're concerned with when the heading gives a historical occasion. When it tells some history. 116 out of the 150 psalms have some kind of heading. Some kind of direction, some kind of background. That's 4/5 of all the psalms. But there's only 11 psalms with the historical occasion. And those are the psalms we want to look at. In other words, it gives you the reason for writing the psalm. This psalm was written when David fled from Absalom. So you know the background. And so you can read in Samuel the story when David fled from Absalom. And you can get some background, see? Or this was written when David fled from Saul and was in the cave of Adullam. So you learn a lot by the historical occasion. You look back in your Bible and you read the history. Then you come and you read the psalm. There's one that says when David was captured by the Philistines. What would you sing about if you were captured by the enemy? That's what we want to look at. We want to see the history. And see what kind of a song that history produced. And we'll study the psalm in relationship to that. The basic idea of this short series then is to study the history and then the songs that God put into the heart of the psalmist in terms of that history. We're going to watch David run and sweat and hide and weep. And as we read these experiences, in each case, God put a song in his heart. What did he sing about when he was in that dark cave? What did he sing about when he was captured by the enemy? When he was running from his renegade son? You see, then we'll know what kind of song God will write in our heart when we go through similar experiences. This raises an interesting question. I want to just sort of introduce this for a while, then we'll get into it. But some have asked this question. Are those headings on the Psalms inspired? In other words, are they in the original manuscripts? Did they come from God, or are they man-made? Was this just man's idea of this psalm, or was it God? The first answer is, they're not inspired. They were not in the original manuscripts. When you go back and find those old manuscripts, you won't find those headings. They're not there. But they are old. Very old. And as I can see, very reliable. I can't say they're inspired because they're not in the original manuscripts. But they're in the Septuagint. You familiar with that word? You know, the Old Testament was written in Hebrew. But they translated it in Greek. And when they translated it in Greek, they called it the Septuagint version. That just means 70. 70 men got together and translated the Old Testament into Greek. That was 150 years before Christ was born. And 150 years before Christ was born, these headings were on the Psalms. One thing that means to me is that's the Bible the Lord Jesus used. He used the Greek Old Testament, the Septuagint. And he used these very headings we have in our Bible. So though I can't say they're inspired, I believe that they're reliable. I know at least one heading is inspired. Now look at Psalm 18, please. Psalm 18, a psalm of David, the servant of the Lord, who spoke to the Lord the words of this song, in the day that the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. See, there's the background. This psalm was written after he was delivered from the hand of Saul. Now, keep that in your mind. I don't say memorize it, but try to remember what we read there. And look in 2 Samuel chapter 22, please. 2 Samuel 22. 2 Samuel 22, verse 1. And David spoke the words of this song to the Lord in the day that the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. You see 22:1? 22:1 is inspired. I know that. It's part of the text. And that's the verse that's used over Psalm 18. So I know at least one heading is inspired, because it's a quote from Psalm 22:1. The purpose of these 11 psalms, as a matter of fact, of all the psalms, every psalm was set to some kind of music. Are you familiar with the fact that the psalms are the hymnal of the Old Testament saints? They sang out of the psalms all the time. God's people are a singing people. Turn for a moment to Psalm 25:15. I think this describes the impact of the 11 psalms we're going to look at. My eyes are continually toward the Lord. He will pluck my feet out of the net. Now, that Psalm 25:15, that's not your natural heart. That's not my natural heart. Psalm 25:15 is a mighty miracle of God. I'll tell you your natural heart if it's anything like mine. I'm going to misquote it backwards. You look at the psalm and I'll do it backwards. Here's how I would have written it. My eyes are continually on the net, because that's my experience very often. The net is a picture of problems. Sometimes it's the net of my own weaving. Sometimes it's the net of someone else's weaving. But my natural heart wants to look at the net. But that isn't what Psalm 25:15 said. Or, my eyes are continually on my feet. Some people live that way. And they're constantly watching their feet. They're in bondage to their feet as much as someone else is in bondage to the net. Got to watch how we walk. Got to watch where we walk. Got to watch where we don't walk. They live a life on eggshells with a bunch of rules and regulations so that their feet don't get dirty. My eyes are continually on my feet. Stumble conscious. An awful lot of people are just always afraid that they're going to do something that dishonors the Lord, or they're going to step in the wrong place or something like that. And they've got their eyes continually on their feet. Or, my eyes are continually on the plucking. See, he says he'll pluck my feet out of the net. The method of deliverance from the net. That's wrong too. That leads to bondage just as much. Those who are always looking at the plucking, the way God delivers them, the method of deliverance, they're victory-centered. They're solution-centered rather than Christ-centered. For them, the Christian life is a deduction of a mathematical formula. There are certain conditions, and if you meet those, God has to bless. He has no choice. That's not the Christian life. Christian life is relationship with a person. Psalm 25:15 says, my eyes are continually on the Lord, not on the net. On the Lord, not on my feet. On the Lord, not on His methods of deliverance. My eyes are continually on the Lord. And whenever David's eyes were on the Lord, God put a song in his heart. We're going to look at 11 of those songs. He looked to the Lord and God put a song on his heart. Now some of those experiences, I believe that they're representative experiences. I tried to think of a negative experience that anyone could go through, not only that I've been through, but that any could go through. And I couldn't find one that wasn't included somewhere in these 11 Psalms. See, there's no positive Psalms of all these headings. They're all bad news. He's running, or he's hiding, or he's doing something else. But in every case, God says, I want to show you how I can give a song in the worst circumstances of life. And I believe that's why he gave these 11 Psalms. It covers everything. You'll never face anything worse than David faced in these 11 Psalms. And in every case, God put a song in his heart. God gave him a song. And that's what we want to look at. The experiences, and they'll be general, so that you can draw a million applications from it and see how God puts a song in our heart. No matter how bitter the pill, no matter how heart-rending the experience, God desires to write a song in our heart. And you'll see it when we go through these 11 Psalms. How many times David got his feet caught in the net. Oh, wow. When you see these Psalms, you'll see some of that. A couple of times, it wasn't only his feet. His whole body was caught in the net. And he was just in a labyrinth of tangles. He was just all tied up. Isn't this marvelous? I only have one responsibility in life. And you only have one responsibility in life. It's not the net, and it's not your feet, and it's not God's method of plucking. It's turning your eyes to the Lord, that's it. My eyes are continually on the Lord. And then He'll put a song in my heart. That's what we want to look at, meditate upon. Are you familiar with George Mueller of Bristol? I think almost everybody has at least heard his name. Bristol, England. He's known as a man of faith. Of course, the thing that made his faith so tremendous was that Christ was the object of his faith. In his ministry, he had an orphanage. And in his ministry, during his lifetime, he personally prayed in $7 million. An amazing thing. He wouldn't tell anybody his needs, only the Lord. And he just told the Lord, but he wrote it down. He kept records. And he wrote it down. And he had $7 million in definite answers to prayer that came in without telling anybody his needs. I say that to show you the burden of his heart. Here's what George Mueller said. I'm quoting George Mueller now. My one responsibility in life is to make certain my soul is happy in the Lord. Isn't that a tremendous thing? Oh, I believe that with all my heart. My one responsibility in life is to make certain my soul is happy in the Lord. See, delight yourself in the Lord, and He'll give you the desires of your heart. That's the only responsibility we ever have. It's God's will that His children always be singing. Always. Never an exception to that. God always has a song for you. God always has a song for me. It seems to me that the historical background of these 11 Psalms are problems at their worst. You see, if God could give David a song in these experiences, then He can always give a song. Singing is for God's people. He's created singing, the ability to sing, for you. The world has prostituted the privilege. They've tried to take it away, but only God's people have a right to sing. The world doesn't have anything to sing about. Only Christians have something to sing about, Christians and birds. The first time singing's mentioned in the Bible is in Exodus chapter 15. And it's the song of redemption. They were redeemed from Egypt by power and by blood. The last time singing's mentioned in the Bible is Revelation 15. They're in their glorified bodies and they're at the throne of the Lamb on the sea of glass, casting down their crowns at His feet. And they're singing, "Worthy is the Lamb." That's the last time it's mentioned in the Bible. Singing for God's children. And you know the central song in the Bible? The first time it's mentioned, it's a song of redemption. And the last time it's mentioned, it's a song of redemption in fully developed form. And you know the middle song in the Bible? The Song of Songs. Song of Solomon. The superlative song. And what's the superlative song? Relationship to the bridegroom of my soul. Well, that's what you sing about. And that's what Solomon was singing about. And that's the Song of Songs. I think Psalm 42:8 gives in capsule form the main message of all of these 11 Psalms. The last part of verse 8 says, "His song will be with me in the night, a prayer to the God of my life." Oh, isn't that a tremendous verse? His song will be with me in the night. Boy, you read some of these things and you know that he was in the night as far as his experiences were concerned. He was in the darkness. Psalm 41 through 3 is a more expanded summary of these 11 Psalms. "I waited patiently for the Lord, and He inclined and heard my cry. He brought me up out of the pit of destruction, out of the miry clay. He set my feet upon a rock and made my footsteps firm. And He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and will trust in the Lord." Well, that's those 11 Psalms. Every negative experience you'll ever face in your life are included in those Psalms. And God longs with an infinite longing to take you out of the miry pit and set your feet upon a rock and put a new song in your heart. Even praise. Now, did you notice how that verse 3 is written? If I were writing the psalm, I'd put it this way. "I'll put a new song in your heart, in your mouth. Many will hear it and trust in the Lord." But it doesn't say many will hear it. It says many will see it. That's an amazing thing. See, how can you see a song? When God really writes a song in your heart, others see it. They don't hear it. They see it in your life. It radiates through your life. And all that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the vocal cords. I'm not talking about your voice. Sometime you'll be able to express the song of your heart with the words of your mouth. But I'm talking about the song that's down deep inside the heart of hearts. And the spirit of spirits, where God is, the song of your heart that others see and trust in the Lord. One of the reasons God allows a variety of experiences in your life. Did you ever get frustrated when things change? Some people just don't like change. My son Daniel is like that. He cannot adjust to change. If everything just continues the same way, even if it's tough, as long as he knows what's coming, it's okay. But as soon as there's any kind of change, he gets in a dither and he gets all frustrated. There's a psalm that says, without changes, they fear not God. God brings changes into your life or you wouldn't trust him. With every change of experiences, it's God's will to write a new song in your heart. A song you've never sung before. A song you wouldn't learn apart from that experience in your life. Don't resist God when he allows changes in your life, even if they're bitter. Because it's his desire and his design to put a new song in your heart. And just say, all right, Lord, I don't know what this is all about, but give me a new song. A song I couldn't have sung if it weren't for this particular experience. It should be the prayer of our life to be able to quote in reality Psalm 104, verse 33 and 34. I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praises to my God while I have my being. Let my meditation be pleasing to him. As for me, I shall be glad in the Lord. Oh, what a marvelous group of verses. I'll sing to the Lord as long as I live, while I have being. I'll sing praises to him. As for me, I shall be glad in the Lord. I looked up sing in Webster. And here's what you get from an uninspired point of view. To be exultant, rejoice, proclaim, extol, to celebrate praises. That's what it means to sing, to celebrate praises. Now, remember, and I have to keep bringing this out, because we're dealing with internal things, not external. A lot of people sing, but they never sing. You know what I mean? They can mouth the words, and they even have beautiful harmony, and they're able to hit high notes and all. That isn't necessarily singing. Singing has to do with the heart. Has to do with the relationship with God. And so I'm not talking about your voice or what notes you can read. I'm talking about an attitude of joy in your heart in all the changing experiences of life. Where way down deep inside, and sometimes that joy will not surface because of the pressures of the experience you're going through. But you'll know down deep inside everything's all right in my Father's house. In my Father's house. In my Father's house. And way down deep, though men may never see it, you'll have that joy, that relationship. Sometimes your experience is a bleeding heart, broken spirit. Your heart, according to Lamentation, my heart affecteth my eye. And sometimes that's going to overflow in tears of sadness. But in spite of it all, no matter how bitter it is, even if you can't swallow, you know you can't sing if you can't swallow. And even if you can't swallow, God writes that song in your heart. That's what I'm talking about. Not being able to memorize certain hymns. When you turn in simple faith to the Lord, my eyes are continually on the Lord, he puts that song in your heart. Let me give you a simple outline of the way we'll approach this. First, we'll go to the historical section and just look at the facts. Now, if we just stayed there, that'd be awful boring. We're just going to look at the facts. Then we're going to go to the psalm and look at the song that was produced by the facts. Then we're going to try to draw a principle, the main principle that's taught by relating this experience with this song. And then we'll try to practically apply the principle in some of the areas of our life. Now, I need to keep reminding myself of this because of the temptation to dig right in. I come to a psalm like Psalm 3 and I don't want to leave it. I just want to study the psalm. But we're not studying the psalm. We only want to get the main message of the psalm. And sometimes that'll take 1 minute. And then you're done with it and we'll leave it. We'll go to the next one. All I want to do is get the main message of the psalm. For example, in the hymns we sing, some of them have verses, right? 3 verses or 4 verses. Or if you study Just As I Am in the original, it has 18 verses. So it depends on what song you sing. But you know that song, Have Thine Own Way, Lord, Have Thine Own Way? The main message of that song is surrender. That I am now yielding to the Lord. Once you see the main message, you're done with the song. I'm not saying study every verse. and study, for example, what it means to absolute sway. Well, it's tremendous. You could spend a long time there and study that. But I just want the main message. That song, Fill My Cup, Lord. Remember that one? The main message is thirst. Having seen the main message, we leave the song. Or take that song, In the Garden. Main message is fellowship with God. Having seen that, we leave the song. And so we're going to come to the Psalms like we come to the hymns. Find the main message. When the world is called up yonder, I'll be there. The main message is assurance. Security for the future. He leadeth me. Main message is guidance. So when we come to a psalm, we just want one thing, not many things. We're not going to study the whole psalm. Maybe someday we'll do that in detail, but not in this series. Let me give you a list of the 11 psalms, and I'm going to take the time to give you the historical reference, because in every case, if you have the New American Standard, I think most of us have that, the cross-reference will tell you where it's found. So it'll save me time if you just look in your cross-reference. Here's the 11 Psalms. Psalm 3, 18, 34, 51, 52, 54, 56, 57, and 142 go together, because they have exactly the same heading and the same historical background. So you get two songs in that experience. That was a real stinger. And so God says, I better give him two songs for that one or he'll never survive it. So God gave two songs there. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Psalm 59, Psalm 60, and Psalm 63. Now these are the only psalms with a definite, so that you're able without question to go right to the Old Testament and say, here's the historical background. God has given me the background on this psalm. Okay, I guess the best thing to do is begin. Any questions about what we're going to do? Do you see why I can't name it? What would you call it? Anybody have any idea? If you come up with something, let me know. All right, turn to the first one then. Psalm 3. We'll look at the psalm and get the background. Then we'll look at the history of it. Then we'll try to get the principle and then try to apply it. Psalm of David, when he fled from Absalom, his son. There's your background. Psalm of David, when he fled from Absalom, his son. Now I'm going to ask, usually I do this and say, we'll save time, I've just written it down and I'll read it to you. But in this particular series, I'm going to ask you to help me along with the donkey work. And we're going to look together at the verses, read them, get the facts, and then try to see the principle. I turn to 2 Samuel chapter 3, please. 2 Samuel chapter 3. First fact, verse 3. We'll start with verse 2. And sons were born to David at Hebron. His firstborn was Ammon by Ahinoam the Jezreelitess. His second, Chileab by Abigail, the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. The third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. All right, there's your first fact. That Absalom was David's third son of one of his many wives. David was a polygamist. He knew in Deuteronomy it said that a king shall not multiply wives. Absalom was the offspring of that relationship that did not please God. He had many wives. 13. This is the next event the Holy Spirit described for us. David had another son whose name was Ammon. That was his firstborn, by another wife named Ahinoam. That made Ammon and Absalom half-brothers. Verse 1 of chapter 13. Now it was after this that Absalom, the son of David, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And Ammon, the son of David, loved her.
You read the record, it's a very ugly record. The half-brother of Absalom loved his sister. 11, and when she brought them to him to eat, he took hold of her and said to her, "Come lie with me, my sister." And she answered him, "No, my brother, do not violate me. Such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this disgraceful thing." Verse 14, however, he would not listen to her. And since he was stronger than she, he violated her and lay with her. And so he raped his sister. Verse 21, when King David heard of these matters, he was very angry. That's as far as it went. He was angry, but he didn't administer any proper judgment or taking. Verse 22 and 23, Absalom did not speak to Ammon either good or bad, for Absalom hated Ammon because he had violated his sister. It came about after 2 years. So for 2 years, Absalom wouldn't even talk to his brother Ammon. The rest of the chapter tells of Absalom's deed. He made a feast and invited all the king's sons, especially Ammon. Verse 28, and Absalom commanded his servant, saying, "See now, when Ammon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, strike Ammon, then put him to death. Do not fear. Have I not myself commanded you? Be courageous, be valiant." And the servants of Absalom did to Ammon just as Absalom had commanded. And all the king's sons rose, and each mounted his mule and fled. And so Ammon is dead by the command of Absalom. Verse 38 shows that Absalom fled for 3 years. Absalom had fled and gone to Geshur and was there for 3 years. Finally, he came back to Jerusalem. But chapter 14, 28 says it was another full 2 years before he saw the king's face. 5 years went by. Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem. Did not see the king's face. But in verse 33, when Joab came to the king and told him, he called for Absalom. Thus he came to the king and prostrated himself on his face on the ground before the king. And the king kissed Absalom. All was forgiven, even though he had murdered his firstborn son. There was no judgment whatsoever. It was a capital offense, and Absalom should have died. But Absalom did not die. Chapter 15 gives the immediate context of Psalm 3. Remember what Psalm 3 says? A psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. This is the same Absalom. Chapter begins, Absalom was a man of charisma. He attracted many people. He was very on his prestige, he attracted a great many people. He drove a magnificent chariot, had 50 people in front of him all the time. Let me read 1 through 6. It came about after this that Absalom provided for himself a chariot and horses, 50 men as runners before him. Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. And it happened that when any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "From what city are you?" And he'd say, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "See, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king." Moreover, Absalom would say, "Oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land, that every man who has any suit or cause could come to me, and I would give him justice." It happened that when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, he'd put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. And in this manner, Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. He made up his mind one day that he was going to have the throne. Purpose was clear. The son of Bathsheba would not follow David. 2 Samuel 15, verses 8 and 9. Your servant vowed a vow while he was living in Geshur in Syria, saying, "If the Lord shall indeed bring me back to Jerusalem, I will go serve the Lord." The king said to him, "Go in peace." But I want to go to Hebron. And he made up a lie, and he said, I've got a vow I've got to fulfill. He fulfilled the vow. He went with 200 men, and he had planned the great insurrection. When you hear the sound of the trumpet, and he had passed, sent his spies up throughout all the land, we're going to anoint me king, and we're going to overthrow David. David finally hears of it in verse 13. A messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. Now we're getting closer to our psalm. Follow these facts. Verse 14. David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, for otherwise none of us shall escape from Absalom. Go in haste, lest he overtake us quickly, and bring down calamity on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. Verse 23. And all the country was weeping with a loud voice, and all the people passed over. The king also passed over the brook Kidron, and all the people passed over toward the way of the wilderness. All the people are weeping. 25 and 26. The king said to Zadok, return the ark to God, of God, to the city. If I find favor in the sight of the Lord, he'll bring me back again and show me both it and its habitation. But if he should say thus, I have no delight in you, behold, here I am. Let him do to me as seems good to him. So he's probably just punishing me anyway. The ark's not going to help. If God wants me dead, I'll die. Otherwise, he'll just kill me. Verse 30. David went up to the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went. And his head was covered and he walked barefoot. Try to picture this. This is the king. We just sort of read these things, la, la, la. David is fleeing from Absalom. Whole city's in turmoil. Everybody's weeping. David is leaving, and he's got the attitude, oh, maybe God's punishing me for something. It doesn't matter. And he's crying, and he's barefoot, and he's weeping. Verse chapter 16, verse 5. When King David came to Baharim, there came out from there a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. And he came out cursing continually as he came. And he threw stones at David and all the servants of King David. And all the people and all the mighty men were at his right hand and his left. And thus Shimei said when he cursed, get out, you man of bloodshed, you worthless fellow. Evidently he was throwing in David's face his sin against Bathsheba and his murder of Uriah. That's what most commentators think. And picture the king now. He's all the people are weeping, and he's weeping, and he's running. And now they're throwing stones at him. He's disgraced. You man of bloodshed, you worthless fellow. Verse 13 and 14. So David and his men went on the way, and Shimei went along the hillside parallel with him, and as he went, he cursed and cast stones and threw dust at him. And the king and all the people who were with him arrived weary, and he refreshed himself there. Okay, those are the facts. The rest of the story is interesting, but it doesn't tie in with the psalm. So you'll have to check that on your own if you want to see the ending. Try to get the impact. David had made many blunders. Deuteronomy 17:17 says, a king shall not multiply wives. He was a polygamist. Ammon committed adultery with his daughter. He did nothing about it. Absalom murdered Ammon, his firstborn son. He got angry, but he did nothing about it. Capital offense, he should have died. Now, David's in trouble. And it's all because of his past sin. It's all because of what he himself had brought upon himself by his own action. Now he's reaping the harvest of what he's sown. Alright? Turn to Psalm 3. Only 8 verses, and they're short, so I'm going to read. Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there's no deliverance for him in God. But thou, O Lord, art a shield about me, my glory, and the one who lifts up my head. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and he answered me from his holy mountain. I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for thou hast smitten all my enemies on the cheek. Thou hast shattered the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Thy blessing be upon thy people. What do you see in Psalm 3? I know this, it's a psalm of victory. It's a psalm of a settled rest, of a confident trust. David's like Peter in prison. He lays down, he goes to sleep. I don't know if all those men were chasing me if I'd get a good night's sleep that night. No wonder when Jonah was in the belly of the sea monster, he quoted from this psalm. He quoted verse 8. Salvation belongs unto the Lord, because Jonah, like David, was in present suffering because of past sin. And he said that's a neat verse to quote, because God helped David. The great principle that I find comparing this song with this history, let me state it first of all in a rather lengthy way, because I want to get the whole thought across, and then I'll try to pound it home. God gave us this psalm, I believe, to enable us to trust God for complete deliverance, even when we're in trouble because of our past sin. So I think God gave this psalm for us. To enable us to trust God for complete deliverance, even when we're in trouble because of our past sin. You see, David's suffering because of his past sin. Absalom never should have been born. He was the result of an illicit relationship. And having been born, he should have died because he committed a capital offense, and David was king. If anybody else committed murder, they would have been killed. But his own son, he let him get away. You see, when I'm in trouble, and that trouble is not caused by sin, will God deliver me? Unqualified, yes. You can expect deliverance if it hasn't come from your sin. When I'm in trouble in my life and it's been caused by my past sin, can I expect deliverance? Yes, again. An unqualified yes. And that's the wonder of this psalm. That's why God gave him this psalm. David was not a victim of his past. David was not in bondage to his past sin. You see the scope of this experience? That's why I say it's a representative experience. God can give you a song even when you've miserably failed in the past. And when you're suffering present results from past sin, God can put a song in your heart. Now note, God hasn't promised to remove all the consequences of your past sin. He hasn't promised to remove all the consequences of your past sin at any moment when you're looking to the Lord, regardless of your past. He will overrule the consequences of your past sin for His glory. Father, you may still have to suffer. You'll have to reap what you sow. But He'll overrule that. And He'll turn the curse into a blessing. Just like the tribe of Levi. The curse was, you're going to have to be scattered because you sinned. Then they repented. And so He scattered them into the best parts of the land. And they got the milk of the land. He turned the curse into a blessing because they looked to the Lord and repented. This brings up a very misunderstood teaching of the Bible. The blending of grace and government. Let me try to explain that to you. God, of course, is always God wherever He appears. He just appears as Himself. He can't change. Sometimes He appears in grace. Sometimes He appears in government. And because He's unchanging, sometimes we can't put that together. And we say grace and government conflict with one another. They contradict each other. But they don't. It's not like this, grace and government. It's like this, grace and government. They go hand in hand. They blend together. Now, let me illustrate it. I think the illustration makes the point clear. Adam sinned against the Lord. Very obviously. Adam sinned against the Lord. And God appeared in grace. Adam wasn't looking for the Lord. God came looking for Adam. God took the initiative. Adam! Adam, where are you? When He found Adam, part of Adam, he continues to show his grace. He curses and silences the serpent. He promises that through the seed of Adam, that Christ was going to come. He slays an animal and provides a coat of skin for them. That's all grace, marvelous display of grace. God seeking man, God cursing the serpent, God promising a redeemer through the human race, God clothing them symbolically with his own provision, his own clothes of righteousness. Now watch. Having given him redemption and having given him a clean robe and having washed out his heart and having cleaned his conscience and having dealt with Adam in grace and said, you're forgiven. I know you had a lousy past. I forgive it. You're clean. You're back in fellowship with me. Now get out of my garden. See, that's what he said. That's the government part. See, he was the object of pure grace, but he was also the object of unflinching government. Every time he looked at his coat of skins, he could say, oh, the marvelous grace of God. Every time he looked at the flaming sword, he had to say, oh, the unflinching government of God. God forgives, but the wheels of government roll on. His guilt is gone, but sweat takes its place. He went out clothed, but he had to go out among thorns and thistles. In his heart, he could sin. He's right with God. His sin was forgiven. He could feast upon the secret fruits of grace. But he had to go out and reap the results of his sin. So don't confuse grace and government. We don't want to rob grace of its charms, but we also don't want to rob government of its majesty. Take it in this context. David, was he forgiven for past sin? Oh yes, God says, I'll wash it all away. You're right with me, a man after my own heart. We'll enjoy sweet fellowship together, and you'll have a song in your heart, and you'll be free. But you better get running, because Absalom's coming. And he suffered the results of his own sin. Galatians 6:7 says, be not deceived, God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that will he also reap. See, the Lord's established certain laws. Physical laws are based on his pleasure. Gravity pulls down. That's because he wants it to. It could go up if he wanted it to. But because he was pleased, it goes down. Physical laws are based on his pleasure. Moral laws are based on his character, not his pleasure. He can change physical laws at any time. He wants to. But he can't change moral laws because they're based on his own pleasure. Physical laws have immediate consequences. Jump in the fire, you're going to get burned right away. Jump off a building, you're going to fall right away. Immediate consequences. Moral laws, when they're violated, also have consequences. But here's the difference. They're not immediate. And that's why Ecclesiastes 8:11 says, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of man is fully set in him to do evil. Because the consequence is removed by some time from the violation. Man thinks he can get away with it. But be not deceived. What a man sows, he's going to reap. That's only so. And he cannot get away with it. Sometimes physical laws illustrate the spiritual laws. Proverbs 6:27-28. Can a man take fire in his bosom and not be burned? That's a physical law illustrating a spiritual law. Can a man walk on hot coals and not be scorched? So is the one who goes to his neighbor's wife. He who touches her will not go unpunished. The physical illustrates the spiritual. And so there's going to be consequences of physical and spiritual. If I walk in fire, I'm going to be burned. If I sink in water, I'm going to drown. If I pitch myself from a high building or bridge, I'm going to be crushed to death. If I passively violate physical law, for example, if I resist the demand for sleep, after a while it's going to tell on me. Not everybody. If I turn, as I often do, a deaf ear to my hunger, you don't believe that, do you? If I never exercise, I better get off these illustrations. Alright. Since physical laws are based on God's pleasure, at any moment if he wants to, he can change them, which he's done so many times. So in one case, iron does float, right? Because it's based on its length, and the axe head did swim. Okay? So sometimes the unstable sea can stand on a heap, right? And Peter can walk on water. Say, well, he can't. That violates the law. No, that's based on his pleasure. He can change that any time he wants to. Sometimes fire is cooler than ice. That's Shadrach. Meshach. If he wants to change physical laws, he can. It's based on his pleasure. But because moral laws are based on his character, even if he wanted to, he can't change them. Numbers 32:23, be sure your sin will find you out. Galatians 6:7, God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, he's also going to reap. I know it sounds absurd and foolish to assert something like this, but it's a lot safer for you to break a physical law and to escape the consequences than to try to break a moral law and escape the consequences. Because God might change the physical law. He can't change the moral law. You're going to have to suffer for that. In other words, you have a far better chance of survival jumping into a hot fire than telling a lie and trying to get away with it. Because God could change the fire into water and make it cool. You have a lot better chance of not being injured running headlong into a tree. You really do. Than to try to sin and get away with it. What a man sows, he's going to reap. And that's what he's saying here. He's saying, David is going to suffer the results of his past sin. Some people have the idea, oh, I've confessed it, and so it's all forgiven, and I can just go out as if nothing ever happened. If I lose my arm in a drunken brawl because I'm out of fellowship with my God, and then I get back in fellowship, my arm's not going to grow back. And for my whole life, I'm going to suffer the penalty of having a loss of a member of my body. If I go out and commit adultery, and through that sin of adultery, I have a child, and then I get right with God, I'm going to have that child as a reminder all the days of my life. There's going to be much suffering because of past sin. And just because God has grace and you're right in your heart and you can enjoy fellowship with God, and do it. Praise God. That's Psalm 3. David had fellowship with his God. God put a song in his heart. He was enjoying the Lord in all his fullness while he ran from Absalom, his son. While he had his head covered and while he wept. While he had to hide in the cave and while his life was threatened every moment. But he didn't fear because he had committed it unto the Lord. And God overruled the consequences of past sin. One illustration that comes to my mind, if you incur heavy financial obligations because of fiscal irresponsibility, will God forgive you for that? Sure he will. You come to God in reality and you can be forgiven as clean as a driven snow. And have a right relationship with God, that's great. But those bills won't go away. That's government. And you're still going to have the obligation. And you might have to suffer all. But you don't have to be a victim of the past. That's Psalm 3. That's what I love about it. You don't have to be in bondage to the consequences of past sin. God gives a song in your heart even when you miserably fail. I love Psalm 107 and verse 17 and 19. Fools cried unto the Lord and were delivered. That marvelous verse. You ever say in so many words, oh, what a fool I've been. What a fool I've been. Fools cried unto the Lord and were delivered. I wouldn't say anything for that verse. Because I know I've been foolish so long. And David could have cried that. I've been so foolish. And look what I'm going through now because I sinned. My life right now is not the same as it would have been if I hadn't sinned against God. But I'm not in bondage to that. God is working all things together for good and using those awful trials that I have to suffer as a result of past sin to make me more like Jesus now and to create the character of God in me and in you. So I think the message of Psalm 3, and all it just has increasingly been in my own heart. By grace, by God's grace, I don't have to be a victim of the past, no matter how ugly, no matter how repulsive that past might be. I can have complete victory. David had victory over past sin. He was able to lay down and go to sleep. He had sinned against God in so many ways. But he went to sleep, and he rose up, and he said, I'm not afraid. I know that I've done wrong, and I know I'm now going through the result. If a man, let's say a master had a field, Jim does a lot of planting. Let's say Jim says to me, I want you to go out and plant wheat in my field. And I go out into the field, and I don't know the difference between wheat and dandelion, or some obnoxious weed. And so I plant the noxious weed, some poison herb or something. And I come back, and Jim tells me what I've done. I say, brother, will you forgive me? Jim puts his hand on my shoulder because he's such a neat guy, and he says, sure, Ed, I forgive you. But you come back in the harvest, and you help me harvest this. And what do you think's going to grow in the fall? I've been forgiven. He forgave me. Now I can expect a whole field of wheat, right? Well, what a man sows, he's going to reap. And I sowed the weeds, and we're going to reap the weeds. Even though I'm forgiven. Even though I'm right with Jim in my relationship. And so you go on in the grace of God and you enjoy it in your heart and you sing in your soul and you enjoy forgiveness and a free conscience and a relationship with God. You walk humbly before men because you might yet be shamed. You still have to suffer the results of your sin. And they might throw dust at you and stones at you. And they might mock you because of your past. Be humble like David was and walk on it. And put the Lord in your heart and say, by and by, I deserve this. Oh, be burdened out saying, oh, now God put me on the shelf and he'll never use me. Grace and government go together. And one doesn't contradict the other. Are any comments or questions about Psalm 6? Alright, that gives you the idea. That's what we're going to do with every psalm. Take the experience and what's the one thing that's taught in each experience. See how that just has an unlimited application? You can just apply anything. All of these have that same kind of thing. Each one's a different experience. And each one will give us a song. Alright, let's start. Our Father, we do thank Thee for Psalm 107, 17, and 19. Fools cried and were delivered. Lord, we thank Thee for experiences like David went through. So that we might have the great truth.